Somewhere out there. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
By the way, a very dear friend of Coast to Coast, and you, of course, John Lear, who has, with Art Bell, put together some compelling talk radio programs right here on Coast to Coast. His friends at the Fantastic Forum have informed me that he's been bitten by a spider, and he seems to be okay, but they would like you, John, to get over to a hospital and get checked out. And I don't want to interfere in your personal life, but I tend to agree. If you've got some of those symptoms that some brown recluse spiders or some nasty other ones could do, just go over there and get checked out and, you know, be safe. Because those things, the poison from those spiders can get to be really nasty. So go do that, John Lear, if you would. Just run up to the hospital and get checked out. In a moment, we are going to talk about Greek mythology. It's called the Parthenon Code. And this is a topic that for years, when I used to go see Hercules movies when I was a kid, I have been fascinated with Greek mythology and the Greek gods. So tonight on Coast to Coast, with a very special guest, Robert Bowie Johnson Jr., we are going to devote some time to talking about the Greek gods and just really, was it all myth or was it real? Well, with the Olympics in Greece, it's only fitting to talk about Greek mythology, the ancient gods. Our guest tonight is Robert Bowie Johnson Jr. We'll call him Bob. Robert Bowie Johnson Jr. has been studying the sacred scriptures, Greek mythology, Greek art, and the Parthenon since 1984. He's a graduate of West Point and an airborne ranger, infantry veteran of Vietnam. His previous two books are Athena and Eden, The Hidden Meanings of the Parthenon's East Facade, and Athena and Cain, The True Meaning of Greek Myth. Welcome to Coast, Bob. How are you? And by the way, thanks for your service to all of us. I always tell veterans that when I talk to them. We appreciate that.
Well, you're welcome, and I am thrilled to be on the show, George.
I have, since I was a kid, been enthralled with Greek mythology. I really don't understand it. I'm looking forward to this because I think I'm going to learn a lot. How did you, especially with your credentials, how did you get involved in this?
Well, I started wondering about it back at West Point because on the academy crest there is featured the helmet of Athena. And she's like, she's like our guardian goddess at West Point. And it's on the class ring and everything like that. So I just started thinking about it, and I knew it had to mean something. And I just started reading books on mythology over the years, and none of them really made any sense to me. Because the Greeks, after all, created the living basis of our culture. I know they didn't just stumble down to the center of town one day and say, hey, you know, we need some gods to worship. How about a goddess of wisdom? Yeah. And how about a god of the forge and maybe a god of wine? What do you think? I mean, that's not the way it happened. They were very sophisticated people, and they knew exactly what they were doing in their art. And Greek art and Greek myth really can't be separated. They're inseparable. Greek art depicts the myth, and Greek myth explains the art. And we have all kinds of art that survives from the ancient world in sculpture and on vase paintings. And the same themes just keep recurring over and over. They keep saying the same thing over and over. And what it turns out to be, Greek myth is the story of mankind told from the Greeks' religious perspective. And now, their perspective was that instead of deluding mankind in Eden, the serpent enlightened mankind in Eden, and it was a good thing to take the fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
Similarities but different at the same time. About what period of time are we talking about with Greek mythology, when they started putting this together in writings and such?
Well, I think Homer goes back to around 750 B.C., the same with the ancient poet Hesiod. About 600 B.C., a group of artists began portraying those myths in art on vases, and by, I'd say, 500 B.C., they developed a lot. And then the classical period, which is about 450 B.C. to 380 B.C., the Parthenon was finished in 432 B.C., and that is like the center of the famous classical era, and that's when their art reached its peak, and their art was all the time expressing the myths and the history of the human race, and that's what hasn't been uncovered. And basically, what we'll be talking about tonight, it's almost like we're on a cold case file, mm-hmm. a cold case investigation. And we're just going to go back to ancient Greece and look around and see if we can figure out what's up, what happened, and take a fresh look at the evidence. And we're going to be amazed at how obvious it is that Greek myth is the history of the human race. It tells the same story as the book of Genesis, except from the point of view that the serpent enlightened mankind.
Okay, all right, and we'll get into that, Bob. Now, in terms of the structure on this planet, we had, of course, a powerful Egyptian civilization, and then we had the Greeks and then the Romans. Was it in that chronological order?
Yes, of course we had Sumerians and Hebrews and so forth, mm-hmm. in the Mideast, and Persians and Babylonians, but Roman mythology is totally borrowed from the Greek. They just changed the names of a few gods, but it's essentially the same story.
How widespread was the influence of Greece during that period of the 500 BC era? Was it all over that region of the planet, or just where we have always known Greece to be?
Well, they sent a lot of colonists out throughout the Mediterranean region.
Okay.
They were the first really to settle Italy, evidently, and to go to Spain. And we've got a lot of vases, Greek vases, come from tombs in Italy from those early days. Okay. And, of course, they went to Egypt, and they went around the Mediterranean region.
Now, to get a really better understanding of Greek mythology, of course, we need to find out a little bit more of who these Greek gods were and how did the myths get created. We had what, Titans and then Olympians as gods at that time period, that was what was created. Am I accurate there?
Well, this is the standard stuff you read in the mythology books, but they don't recognize that it's history. So they classify things in a way that really doesn't make any sense. And the biggest celebration that the Greeks had was their victory, the Greek gods' victory over the giants. That's what they called them, the giants.
And you think they were really giants? Because we've always heard this now from a number of people, that this planet had giants roaming the planet. I mean, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, even taller foot people. Do you believe that?
I don't know about that, because these giants were spiritual giants, when you really analyze
the
facts. And they represented the Yahweh-believing sons of Noah. And that's what Greek religion celebrates. Greek mythology, Greek religion celebrates the victory over Noah and his Yahweh-believing sons. Those were the gods. That was depicted on one part of the Parthenon. There was a huge monument, the altar of Zeus, at a place called Pergamum, which that was the main frieze. It just showed god after god crushing these giants, and they're not battling them. Some scholars say it's the battle between the gods and giants. Every time it's depicted, the giants are being crushed. They're on the ground. They're being beaten. Often they're being beaten down by the gods, and the serpent is helping the gods to defeat these giants. So, I mean, that's one way of expressing what Greek religion is about. It's celebrating that victory over Noah and his Yahweh-believing children. Now, if you think back to the history, after the flood, Noah and his immediate family, and for a number of years, maybe up to 100, 200 years after that, everybody was very respectful of God. And everybody worshiped God because of the flood, but then gradually there developed this desire to get back to the way of Cain, to get back to the serpent's wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And the leader in this effort, according to the scripture, was a guy named Nimrod. Now, what the Greeks did, Nimrod, Heracles, the great Greek hero Heracles, is that Nimrod figure transferred back to Greek soil.
Now, were these names you're giving us tonight, were they real people, or were they myths?
They were absolutely real people. Heracles is celebrated on the great temple of Zeus at Olympia. He's celebrated on the Parthenon. He's probably his picture, or his painting, appears on more Greek vases than any other figure. Why would you paint someone that didn't exist so many times? And he had a series of 12 labors. And what was that all about? Why would he have 12 labors? Well, his 12 labors tell the story of the Greek religious system overcoming the Yahweh-believing sons of Noah and changing the religious orientation of Greek humanity. I mean, his first labor, he killed a lion, which is a symbol of earthly power. And he wore the head of the lion himself in his subsequent labors. But you can see where he's headed, because he's headed toward his final labor. And his final labor is to get back to this paradise called the Garden of the Hesperides.
Is that the same as the Garden of Eden?
It's exactly the same as the Garden of Eden. And he wants to get back there to get one of the golden apples from the serpent's tree. And to get there, he kills this three-bodied man named Geryon. And there are no there were no three-bodied men in the ancient world. But Noah had three sons.
Ah.
And that represented his overcoming the authority of the three sons of Noah. In fact, if you entered into the Temple of Zeus at Olympia, and they'll probably show that because a lot of this survives from the Temple of Zeus at Olympia, because in the Olympics are going to show this kind of thing. Right over the entrance, they had a sculpture of him overcoming the three-bodied man representing the authority of Noah's sons. And they had a depiction of his receiving the apples. And you read it just like you would read a comic strip panel. What did Heracles do? By overcoming the authority of the sons of Noah, he was able to get back to the apples in the serpent's garden.
Now, when he overtook the sons of Noah, is it a reality? Did he kill them in reality, or was that again something else?
Well, I think it depends on the individual myth. I think this one, I don't think he literally killed Shem, Ham, and Japheth. I think that depiction, which is shown on many vases and many sculptures, shows he overcame their authority. And in some cases, I think he actually killed people, but in others, it's almost metaphorical. The artists are trying to tell us that story. And how else do they? There's another one where he is wrestling away the authority from Noah, and Noah actually appears very often in Greek art, but he has the name Nereus, and Nereus means the wet one.
Ah, all right, okay.
And he's also called the salt sea old man, and
so one could assume through just the Greek mythology and what we see in the book of Genesis that Noah was indeed a real person, right? Can we assume that?
Well, I think so.
Yeah.
And the Greeks knew exactly who he was. And you'd be surprised how I've got 17 vase depictions of Noah in my book, The Parthenon Code. 17 vase depictions and one sculptural depiction. And what they used him to put him in certain scenes. For example, in this battle of the gods defeating the giants, which was depicted, and these sculptures survive from that, and they're in a museum in Berlin. Everybody's engaged in the battle except two figures. Nereus, the Greek Noah, and his wife, Doris. And the artist put them in there to watch it. And that's like a frame of reference. And then they put him, they put Nereus in scenes where he watches the birth of Athena. And Athena represents the new Eve of the Greek age. And she's born full grown. Excuse me, George.
Yeah.
Sorry. She's born full grown out of Zeus. And this appears on many vases, and the poet said so. Now, who else was born full grown out of a man?
Eve. It was just
sure,
Eve.
It's a picture of Eve being born full grown out of Adam.
So you think Athena and Eve are one and the same?
There's no doubt about it. Let me give you an example, and how an example of how easy it is to grasp this artist code and see how obvious it is, and it's loads of fun. Once you get it, you can actually understand what Greek vases mean. You can understand Greek sculpture because the Greeks were trying to communicate to us, and they were communicating to their fellow countrymen about who they were and where they came from. And where was I getting to here?
Well, we were talking about Eve coming.
Oh, right. Okay. Now, the Parthenon, the great temple of Athena, stood on the Acropolis of Athens, and we'll see that a lot during the Olympics, the ruins of it.
Right.
High on the city was a temple to Athena. And you walked in the east entrance, and there was a huge 40-foot golden ivory statue of Athena. Now, the first thing you would recognize when you saw her, you'd see it's a woman. It's a woman. And rising up next to her is a huge was a huge serpent as a friend. So the message is, here's a woman who's friends with the serpent.
Well, now, why in Greek mythology is the serpent considered something good, yet in Genesis or the Bible, the serpent is considered evil or the devil? Why the disparity there?
I mean, that's just the way things are. I mean, those are the two takes you can take on what happened in the Garden of Eden. Either the serpent was telling the truth, or the serpent, God was telling the truth. I mean, the Hebrews and Christians look at the serpent as deluding Adam and Eve.
Right.
The Greeks felt like it was a liberating experience, that at last they had the knowledge of good and evil, because their outlook is fundamentally humanistic. The Greeks, ancient Greek religion is the really fundamental expression of humanism. Their humanism, they believe that man was the measure of all things, not God. The Hebrews, of course, believe that God was the measure of all things. But if we look back at that statue of Athena, okay, so you walk in there and you see this huge serpent next to the woman who's friends with the serpent. And in Athena's right hand, she held a small statue of Nike, which represented victory. So there's the message right there. The woman's friendship with the serpent has led to our victory. Then on the statue base of her ancient idol image was sculpted the gods giving gifts to Pandora. And most everybody today knows who Pandora was, and all the Greeks did. She was the one who allowed evil into the world. So that huge statue of Athena was literally based on an obvious picture of Eve. Then on her chest, Athena wore the Gorgon Medusa, the head of serpents, and that's symbolize where she got her authority.
All right, now that mythology, I was talking about that last hour, was what I've always heard was that if you looked at Medusa's head with her head full of snakes, you'd turn into a pillar of stone. Is that just mythology, or is that in reality what they really believed?
Well, I think it's a genuine curse that's actually operative today. And that sounds fantastic.
How does that work? What do you mean?
Let me explain. Okay, now, the original myth, a character named Perseus went to get the head of the Gorgon Medusa, and he would turn to stone if he looked directly at her.
Right.
And so what he did, he used his shield as a mirror to look at her indirectly and cut off her head. Then the next part, he had a few adventures, but you have to follow where these things wind up. The Gorgon Medusa, the head of serpents, wound up on Athena's chest. Okay? And it's right, so if you look at her statue, that's the focal point. You see that Gorgon Medusa. And if you look at her, just look at her and try to understand who she is, your mind will be stultified. Your mind will turn to stone in a sense. You won't be able to, like the scholars have never been able to understand how obvious it is that Athena is a representation of Eve.
Right, right.
Because they look at that and the stare of the Gorgon Medusa mesmerizes them. You've got to look away from Athena and see her indirectly as she's portrayed in the book of Genesis.
It's like a code, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a code. Now, see, that's the code, the Parthenon code actually is... it's a simple method of expression.
All right, hold that thought, Bob. We're going to take this quick break, and we'll be right back with you as we talk about the Parthenon Code and Greek mythology. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
To access the audio archives of Coast to Coast AM, log on to coasttocoastam.com. Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
You know, the movie that's out, Troy, really highlights, I think, Achilles. You know the story of that, of course. He got shot with an arrow in the heel, and then he died. And of course, that's where you always get the Achilles heel talk. But, again, Greek mythology. And we'll be back with our guest, Robert Bowie Johnson, in a moment as we talk about the Parthenon Code. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest tonight, Robert Bowie Johnson, Jr., the book, The Parthenon Code. Robert, in order to get a better perspective, of course, of the Parthenon Code, some of the names of the Greek gods that we've always heard about, were they real? I mean, you've mentioned Zeus, for example. Was that a real person during this era?
Haven't you ever wondered why... all the Greek gods looked exactly like human beings?
All of them.
All of them. There might be an exception here, and I can't think of any, but they all looked exactly like human beings because that's who they were. And basically, it's a form of, a sophisticated form of ancestor worship is what Greek mythology is. Even Socrates, the famous philosopher, said in one of Plato's dialogues that the gods were his lords and ancestors. He comes right out and says that.
Well, did they have those special powers, godlike powers?
Well, I mean, I think they imagined that there was some power there. There's power in your ancestry. There's power in the genes that created you. But the first couple, according to Greek myth, was Zeus and Hera. They're the first couple. And the first couple, according to the Christian Jewish tradition, are Adam and Eve. And those pairs match up perfectly because Zeus and Hera were a brother-sister, husband-wife pair. Adam and Eve were a brother-sister, husband-wife pair. Adam is the father of all mankind. Zeus was called the father of all mankind and the father of gods and men. Eve's name in Hebrew means mother of all living. Hera was called the mother of all. The Greeks worshipped Hera as the goddess of marriage because she was Eve, the first woman to get married.
Well, I thought Athena was Eve.
Okay, now that's a very good point. Now, Hera is the primal Eve. But the way of Cain, which revered this humanity, was wiped out during the flood. And what the Greeks do is they express the rebirth of the serpent system after the flood. So Athena represents the reborn serpent's Eve after the flood.
Ah, okay. Whatever this new generation was, that's what she was.
Yes, and in fact, the whole labors of Heracles, excuse me, tell that story, because throughout the labors of Heracles, Athena is always helping him, and Hera is always hindering him. That's because Hera knows that at the end of the labors, Athena is going to rise up and be the chief goddess, and she's going to move to the background. But she's still the original Eve, and still the mother of all mankind.
All right, pre-flood, what happened to Zeus and Hera?
Well, that's pre-flood, the question is, what happened to Adam and Eve? And they died. But they had offspring. And just as Adam and Eve had two antagonistic sons,
right?
So did Zeus and Hera have two antagonistic sons. And the Greek god Hephaestus, god of the forge, was the eldest son of Adam and Eve, and he corresponds to Cain. And if you look in Genesis, the family of Cain were the first forgers of all the tools of copper and iron. So he's Vulcan in Rome. He's the god of the forge, and that corresponds directly to Cain. Then there's the other son is Seth. Now, we don't count Abel because Cain killed Abel without offspring, and Seth replaced him.
Right.
And Seth is the line through whom, Christ was descended. So you've got, from the Christian Jewish point of view, the way of Cain is bad, and the way of Seth is good. From the Greek point of view, the way of Cain is good, the way of Hephaestus is good, and the way of Seth is bad, and the one that shows up in Greek myth as Seth, that is the bad son of Zeus and Hera, is Ares. And he's called Mars in the Roman system.
Now, well, explain this for me, though, Bob. In Christianity, the impression is, at least what I've always believed, was that we had the Adam and Eve, we had just these two human beings on this entire planet, whether you believe it or not. You know, it basically said there were two people and they started and things. Do the Greeks believe the same thing?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
They believe the exact same thing, and that's, I think, the importance of the Parthenon Code, that it reveals this, that the whole Greek religious system tells the exact same story as the Book of Genesis, the same characters, the same events, but from the opposite slant, and they celebrate what Greek religion really is. Greek mythology is a celebration of the rejuvenation of the way of Cain after the flood. You can put it another way. It's a celebration of overcoming Noah and his Yahweh-believing children.
Well, did they not like Noah?
Well, they never harm Noah. There's many vase depictions of Heracles pushing him out of the way, obscuring him, wrestling away his authority. He was very, very... You mentioned in the Achilles.
Right.
From the movie Troy. Achilles claimed descent from Noah. And Achilles, of course, they called him Nereus. That's the Greek name for him, the wet one. And again, the salt sea old man, they called him all that. And I've got 17 vase depictions of this Nereus in the Parthenon Code, and there's no doubt that it's Noah. You can't. He's and plus the ancient writers describe him in the same way. Hesiod and Homer describe him in the same way Genesis does. He's a just man, a good man, and so on. Plus, now Genesis says that Noah had that Noah lived for 350 years after the flood.
Right.
The Greeks say that he had 50 daughters.
50.
By the same woman.
Pretty busy guy. Pretty busy woman, too.
Yeah. And now, Genesis doesn't name his wife, but the Greeks called her Doris. So the two people that survived the flood, according to the Greeks, were Nereus, the wet one, and his wife Doris. And they had these 50 daughters. Now, I get to Achilles. This is absolutely fascinating. There are many vase depictions of his daughters around an altar.
Oh, and let me ask you this, too, and I don't want to interrupt you, but because this all fascinates me. Do they also, in Greek mythology, talk about the ark coming to rest on Mount Ararat or anything like Genesis does?
I haven't seen anything that talks about that. They begin with Noah himself, and they define the development of their religious system in relation to Noah.
Okay, but they don't get into where the ark came to rest or anything like that.
No, but the idea that Noah is depicted on at least 17 vases and in one sculpture, I mean, that's important evidence that he existed.
I agree with that.
And the whole Parthenon, again, this is the Parthenon Code, Mankind's History in Marble. The Parthenon was the most sculpted temple of antiquity, and it told the history of mankind, the story of mankind, and it had seven different sculptural themes on it, and virtually every sculptural theme related to Noah in some significant way. He doesn't appear on there, but his son-in-law, Poseidon, appears on there. His sons and his daughters appear on there being defeated by the gods, and that's what the Parthenon is celebrating. His cloak is there. That Athena has taken his cloak, which is a symbol of his authority, and so they've been looking on Mount Ararat for a long time for evidence of Noah. There's plenty of evidence of Noah's existence on a smaller mountain, the Acropolis of Athens, and I show all this in the Parthenon Code. And I've got a lot of this on my website. I've got pictures of Noah on my website, not pictures, but. Well, pictures of the ancient ark.
Sure.
Now, I don't think anybody has a photograph of Noah.
Tell us, boy, if they do, they have something, huh?
They do.
Tell us a little bit about the Parthenon itself.
Okay, the Parthenon, well, if you've ever seen, like, army barracks, where they have those 20-by-60 wood frame huts, I mean, it's the
right.
Same. But the Parthenon is 30 meters by 70 meters, sitting on the top of the Acropolis of Athens with a porch and columns around it. It's got that pitched roof. And it had a pediment on each end. Now, a pediment is just like on we got the pitched roof, you have a gable. You got that triangular space on the short end of the temple. And they were the pediments, and they were filled with sculpture, and they each had a sculptural theme. In fact, on the west pediment, the flood and its aftermath was depicted by the Greeks because they're announcing who they are, and they're saying, well, we're the ones that took over after the flood. That's what they're saying. And then underneath the pediments, they have square sculptures. And you have to read them almost like comic book panels. But it's that easy to read them. They tell stories. And under the east pediment, the theme is the gods defeating the giants. That is the Greek religious system overcoming the Yahweh-believing sons of Noah. Then under the west pediment, it's the Greeks defeating the Amazons. And haven't you ever wondered why Greek heroes had to kill women? I mean, Heracles killed the Amazon queen Hippolyte.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Achilles killed one. And all the heroes were expected to kill these women. Well, who were these women? Well, it turns out that this is depicted on the Parthenon. It turns out that they were the outraged daughters of Nereus, the Greek Noah. And this whole thing I have a vase in the book by a guy named Cleophrates.
What were they outraged about?
What they were outraged about, and this is depicted on vases, there was a Zeus worshiper named Peleus. Now, Peleus was Achilles' father, okay?
All right.
Peleus is Achilles' father. He goes to this where these daughters of Noah or Nereus are worshiping by an altar, and the altar is depicted on the vase. And like he's tackling her, he's abducting her. That's what it looks like. He's getting down, tackling her, and picking her up on his shoulder, carrying her away. And on the vases, the sisters have their arms up and they're running around, and they run to Nereus, who is real old, and he doesn't do anything. He doesn't do a single thing. And so then this Zeus worshiper takes away the daughter of Noah, and they get married in front of an altar of Zeus, and all the gods attend this thing. Now, this is in Greek myth. I mean, this is, you can look in the Greek myth books, it's right in there.
Right.
But what happened? What happens when this woman is abducted from the altar of Noah? Well, Eris, or conflict, enters. And she comes uninvited to this wedding of the two of them and throws in an apple that says on it, to the fairest. And then this is where the whole Trojan thing begins, because Paris is selected to choose which of the three goddesses that want to be the fairest will be chosen, and he accepts the bribe that if he'll accept Aphrodite as the fairest, then he gets the most beautiful woman in the world, Helen of Troy. So that's the way it goes down, and he goes and gets Helen of Troy, but she's already married in Greece, and he takes her back to Troy, and that's what started the war. But it began with the abduction, and of course, the abduction of Noah's daughter from before the altar, and then all the conflict began. And in a way, that's really what happened after the flood. Everything was fine. Everything was peaceful. Everyone was God-fearing until 150 years, 200, I don't know how long it was, before this hankering for humanism and the serpent's enlightenment, you know, got a hold of humanity again.
I always had been told that the Garden of Eden was in Iraq, near the Euphrates River, in the Tigris River. Yet, talking to you, it sounds like it might have been more near Greece. Is there a difference here?
Well, I mean, everybody has their own perspective. Now, they called it the Garden of the Hesperides, the Greeks did, and it's depicted on a great many vases, and it's always depicted with a serpent-entwined apple tree. And if you look at Genesis, it doesn't say what kind of tree it was. The very idea that Eve ate an apple comes to us from the Greek tradition, from that garden. Now, Hesperides means the west, and that's where the garden is the nymphs of the west. And that's where the garden was supposed to be. And it matches Genesis because it says that civilization developed to the east of Eden. So to get back to this ancient paradise, the Greeks remembered as part of their collective cultural memory, they had to get back, they had to go west to the Garden of the Hesperides. And again, this is where Heracles had to get on his final labor to solidify what the Greek religious system was trying to do. Get back to the serpent's enlightenment, get God out of the picture. Now, Atlas was one of the gods there, and Atlas is depicted very often in the Garden of the Hesperides, and what he's doing is he's pushing up on the heavens. He's not holding the earth, as some people think.
Right, yeah, holding up the big globe, no.
That's not what the ancient myths say or what the ancient artists depict. He's pushing away the heavens, and with them, the God of the heavens, so the Greek religious system can develop.
Now, let me ask you this with regards to that in terms of mythology. A lot of people will speculate, now I'm going to ask you this, that the gods, specifically the Greek gods, came down from another planet, that they did not originate on Earth. What do you think of that theory?
Well, the Greeks tell a far different story. Their whole religious system is their religious history, and if the history matches Genesis perfectly, Zeus and Hera match Adam and Eve. They had two sons, Hephaestus and Seth match Ares and Hephaestus, or Cain and Seth match Hephaestus and Seth. Hephaestus and Ares. I'm sorry, but anyhow, they had two children, you know, and everything significant pertains to events that are reported in Genesis. So the Greeks,
well,
I mean, where did they get this?
Well,
if it weren't part of their collective cultural memory.
Okay, Genesis does say, though, what was it? Sons of God came down and mated with the daughters of man?
Well, no, that's a misinterpretation of Genesis 6. And if you get the concordant version from the Concordant Publishing Concern, it clears it up, because these same people that mated with the women, they took the women that they chose. It says something like that. They took the women they chose. Now, throughout Greek art, centaurs, which are really centaurs are depicted abducting women, taking them away. And
well, what were they?
They, to the Greeks, the centaurs or kentaurs, the half men, half horses, represented the line of Seth, the line that they were opposed to. And very often on Greek vase paintings, they carried symmetrical branches over their shoulder.
All right, but surely we didn't have half man, half horses running around this planet, right?
No, that's why kentaur means hundred. And I think it refers to the fact that Noah warned for 100 years that there was going to be a flood. And of course, he was part of the line of Seth. So he would be a kentaur.
Now, do you believe, and do the Greeks believe, that Noah was warned about this flood from God?
No, their whole thing is they don't want anything to do with God. There's no creator God in the Greek religious system.
Nothing.
No. I mean, they begin with Adam and Eve.
Well,
that's where they're all descended, well, with Zeus and Hera.
All right, when we come back at the top of the hour, Bob, I want to ask you, how the Greeks believe mankind started then. I mean, with the belief, of course, of Adam and Eve, or Zeus and Hera, how did they start? I mean, at least with Christianity, they have a logical beginning with a God. I let's get your take on that when we come right back.
The official website of Coast to Coast AM is www.coasttocoastam.com. Log on now. City of Angels, Premier Radio Network presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Bob Johnson's website linked up right now with his name on the coasttocoastam.com website, the parthenoncode.com. It is that simple. If you're having trouble spelling Parthenon, don't worry. Just click the link that is on coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest, Robert Bowie Johnson, Jr., Bob. Bob, in Christianity, we talk about the fact that Adam and Eve, first human beings created by God. What do they say in Greek mythology with the beginning of Zeus and Hera?
Okay. Now, the ancient poet who tells about where the Greeks came from and how things began was named Hesiod. and they believe he lived around 750 BC or whatever. And his account of how things began matches Genesis perfectly. But there's one thing you have to see about Genesis. Verse 2 in the King 1:2 in the King James Version is not correct. It says, well, it begins by saying, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form and void. I mean, that's just not possible. There must be something wrong with that translation, because if there were an earth, it would have to have form.
Mm-hmm.
It couldn't
mm-hmm.
be without form. But the concordant literal version of Genesis gets it right. The verse 2 says, and the earth became a chaos and vacant, and darkness was on the surface of the submerged chaos. And then God began his work of restoring the disrupted earth to it the way it is today, according to the scriptures. But the key is, it's chaos is in Genesis 1:2. And Hesiod says, at first chaos came to be. That's where he begins. He can't get back to in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, but he does get back to chaos. Okay, and then he says, out of chaos came nyx, and nyx is darkness. Out of chaos, and it says right in Genesis, and darkness was on the surface of the submerged chaos. Then he says, out of nyx, or out of darkness, came the Hesperides, which represents the ancient garden, the Garden of the Hesperides, and the ruthless avenging fates. And, of course, the fates brought death into the world. So you've got the same thing. You've got a paradise garden that they believed in, and then death enters in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same thing that the book of Genesis teaches. And this is expressed up on our website, theparthenoncode.com, which you mentioned. We have a flash presentation of the east pediment of the Parthenon, restored in color, and that's where the Greeks retell this story. That's where they summarize who they are and where they came from. And darkness appears in the right corner, disappearing, and then the Hesperides appear. That's what's on the cover of the book, where you can see the garden, the women in the garden with the serpent and twine tree.
Yeah, okay. Okay. I'm looking at that right now, as a matter of fact.
And, there, of course, there's Atlas there pushing up on the pediment, pushing away the heavens, and with them the god of the heavens. And so in the center of the pediment can stand Zeus, who is a picture of Adam, the first human. And so they, all the Greeks said that they're the first couple was Zeus and Hera. And so they correspond exactly to Adam and Eve. And the ancient writers say that they began in this garden. So, in fact, you see, talking about the difference between Hera as the original Eve and Athena representing the rebirth of the serpent's Eve after the flood, Hera, according to the mythologists, originally had the golden apples. And supposedly she got them as a wedding present from Zeus, the golden apples from the serpent's tree. After the flood, when Heracles makes it back to the garden where the serpent is again and gets the golden apples that once belonged to Hera, he gives them now to Athena
mm-hmm.
to show that she's the new Eve of the Greek age.
So we agree, and I say we, that Christianity and Greek mythology, there was a major flood, wiped out probably all of civilization, and that it regenerated once again.
Yes, and we were talking before about what happened before the flood. What I believe Genesis says is that the people in the line of Seth, which is the line of Christ and supposedly the good line coming from Adam and Eve, as opposed to the line of Cain, which
right.
is the bad line that doesn't believe in God and killed Abel and so forth,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that what happened is men in that line took women from the line of Cain, and those women, being associated with those women and their offspring, they fell right into the way of Cain themselves until there was only one family from the line of Seth that was pure in that sense, that they were still Yahweh-believing, and they shunned the line of Cain and the way of Cain, and that was the family of Noah.
Okay, so that was it. That was, and then the flood came.
And the Greeks depicted that in a very interesting way, and it's depicted throughout Greek art and in sculpture. They've visualized the flood as a man named Cainius, and that's how they spell it, K-A-I-N-E-U-S. And K-A-I-N is the Greek way of spelling the Cain from the Bible, so
mm-hmm.
it's the same figure. And eus at the end of a word means pertaining to. So Canius is not just one man. He represents the line of Cain. And he's being beaten into the ground by centaurs, or centaurs with boulders. And it's just, that's how they visualize what happened during the flood. In a sense, that's what happened. The whole line of Cain got beaten into the earth by the line of Seth. And then what happens after the flood, there's a little baby born, the earth-born one, who is of the seed of Cain, and the line of Cain comes back into being. And this is a huge birth, and it's pictured on the front of my book, Athena and Cain, The True Meaning of Greek Myth, this little baby coming up out of the earth into Athena's arms. The reborn serpent's Eve welcomes the reborn line of Cain. And it's a fascinating story from Greek myth because Hephaestus, now remember, Hephaestus is the oldest son of Zeus and Hera, and he corresponds to the oldest son of Adam and Eve, Cain. And he goes chasing after Athena, supposedly, rubs up against her, ejaculates into the earth, and out of the earth comes this child who is the newborn seed of Cain that the Greek world welcomed. And I don't think he chased Athena or anything like that. The whole story is the form of the story is meant to just to keep the idea that whose seed this is. This is the rebirth of the way of Cain. On my website, I contrast the birth of Christ, which everybody's familiar with. Even atheists, when they look at, they see a scene of the birth of Christ, they know exactly what it is.
This baby, does he have any specific name or?
Well, I call him little Eric because he's got one of those funny Greek names, Erichthonios, which means the earth-born one. But he represents the rebirth of the way of Cain after the flood, and that's what the Greeks are celebrating. And in the book I put one of the vase depictions of Canius being beaten into the ground during the flood, the line of Cain being beaten into the ground during the flood.
Well, let me ask you about the similarities, Bob.
Okay.
Why, and this is fascinating as well, different regions of the planet, and you know, you had the Middle East, you had them all over the place. Why are there similarities from these various different cultures, yet these people were from, or at least they were supposed to be, from different regions around the planet? How did the similarities all occur, or why did they occur?
Well, I believe that my research is, I think, solid evidence for it, but I think the book of Genesis stands on its own. I believe the book of Genesis in the original Hebrew and translated concordantly is the truth. That's what happened. And the whole Greek religious system backs that up. Now, I don't really understand Egyptian myth, but I'm fairly positive that those myths and that art tells the same story that the Greeks tell.
Right.
But they tell it maybe a little different way.
Sure.
But they're going to tell about the rebirth of the way of Cain after the flood. For example, okay, you might remember an ancient Greek symbol, a serpent surrounding the sun. That symbolizes the serpent's enlightenment. And if you look in Egyptian art, the pharaohs always had a serpent coming out of their on their hat.
All right, but do the Greeks talk about or illustrate what caused the flood?
No, they.
I've always wondered if, you know, there was some calamity, a polar shift on this planet, something that happened to create a flood of such magnitude.
No, they just depict it as being victims of the line of Seth, that they were beaten into the ground by these centaurs who represent the line of Seth. And after the flood, there's many vase depictions of these centaurs being battered by the Greeks, by Heracles and others. They're getting their revenge. And just as before the flood, the line of Seth abducted the Cain women and took them, after the flood, it was this Zeus worshiper I was telling you about, Achilles' father Peleus, who abducts one of Noah's daughters from right in front of an altar of Yahweh and takes her away into Zeus religion, which is what eventually led to the Trojan War.
Now, does the Greek mythology, the Greek, basically that, they do not believe in the devil. They don't believe in evil?
Oh, you know, they got their own standards of things, certainly. But it says in the scripture that the adversary of God in Christ is transfigured into a messenger of light. And so the idea of the devil being out there sneaking around with a tail and poking everybody and trying to, it really doesn't jive with the scriptures. He comes as an angel of light. And guess what Zeus's name means in Greek? It's Dios in Greek. It means light. And there was one mythologist that says that his name Dios means more than that, that it means the actual moment of lighting up. And the actual moment of lighting up, as far as humanity is concerned, is in that garden when they took the fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So his very name connects him.
Go ahead. Does the mythology somehow ever, from these Greek gods that we've been talking about, what happened to them? Where did they go eventually? Did they just die off? Do they depict that at all?
I could tell you the story of whether they still have some kind of spiritual power or not, I don't know, but there's an interesting story about the altar of Zeus, which was at a place called Pergamum. Now, in the book of Revelation, it says that that's where the throne of Satan is. And chapter 2, verse 13, that's where the throne of Satan is. And if you actually go to this place, Pergamum, which is on the western coast of Turkey, across from Athens, what was there was the altar of Zeus. And what was depicted on that altar were the gods defeating the giants. That is to say, the Greek religious system overcoming the Yahweh-believing sons of Noah. And so that fits with what it says in the scriptures. But about 1000 A.D., that monument, the altar of Zeus, the throne of Satan, whatever you want to call it, got destroyed to some degree and knocked into the dirt during certain battles that were used for defensive purposes. And in about 1880, a guy from Germany named Humann, who was there doing some road work, uncovered them. And over a period of 50 years, they gradually took this altar of Zeus, the throne of Satan, back to Berlin and reassembled it and opened it to the public in 1930, just before Hitler's rise to power. And we know how he hated the line of Seth, or hated Jews and so forth. Now,
sure.
I just mentioned that as a coincidence, and I'm not saying that that proves anything, but it's a very interesting coincidence that the throne of Satan, the altar of Zeus, was reassembled in Berlin in 1930.
Is it still there?
It's still there. It's called the Pergamum Museum in Berlin.
How big is it? I mean, is it huge?
It's very big. It's very big, and the sculptures that run all the way around it are very big, but bigger than life size, and they show the gods, Athena, Zeus, Hera, and even more gods than you can think of because of such a huge frieze, killing these with the help of the serpent, killing these Yahweh-believing sons of Noah called the giants.
How advanced do you think they were? In terms of, of course, if the pyramids were indeed 5,000-10,000 years older than most people believe, maybe even more, the Parthenon is a pretty darn fascinating structure all by itself. I mean, how did these people in that period, how did they build this thing?
Well, there's books on that explain how they built it, but it's supposed to be, people have described it as the most important monument in the history of Western civilization. We're going to see it all the time, the ruins of it during the Olympics.
Right. They've shored it up a little bit, right?
Yeah, they've shored it up a little bit, but the question becomes, and it was the most sculpted ancient Greek temple. What do the sculptures mean? None of the scholars know. And I'll give you an example of some of the things they say. On the east, you've heard the story of Poseidon, and this is a Greek myth now. Poseidon and Athena have a contest to see who's going to be the god of that city.
And Poseidon, of course, he came out of the ocean, they said, right?
Well, he offered, each Poseidon and Athena each offered, according to the myth, the people a gift to see. And so Poseidon offered a salt spring on the Acropolis, the high place of the city. And Athena offered the olive tree. And the people took the olive tree right away and made Athena their goddess. Now, that's absurd. I mean, that's really ridiculous. First of all, what good is a salt spring on the top of the Acropolis? Now, investigators have gone back there, and there is no, and there never was any salt spring on top of the Acropolis.
Now, what do you mean by salt spring?
I don't know. I mean, a spring that goes down into the earth and brings up salt water.
Okay, all right.
But what scholars have concluded is there was a pool, and this is mentioned in the ancient records. There was a pool of salt water on the Acropolis. Now, how would a pool of salt water get on the Acropolis, except that the ocean covered it? So that's the story within the story, that the ocean covered the Acropolis. Then afterwards, Athena presents the olive tree, which from Noah we know that's a symbol of the New Age.
So you're saying at one point the Parthenon was underwater?
No. This goes way back before the Parthenon was built. This is one of their ancient myths.
Okay.
Right, that there was a salt spring or there was a salt pond puddle on the Acropolis, and that can only mean it was covered with water.
Okay.
And then when you tie it in with Genesis, then Athena usurps the symbol of the olive tree, which is what the dove brought that branch back to Noah, as a symbol that she was in charge of the New Age now. She's got the olive tree.
Okay, I'm looking at a picture of the Parthenon in your book now.
Okay.
And it's the one on 123. And I'm trying to figure out, when they built this, what was its purpose?
Well, its purpose was threefold, I think. And all these things are tied in together. They're celebrating the rejuvenation of the way of Cain after the flood. They're celebrating the rebirth of the serpent's Eve after the flood. And by serpent's Eve, I mean the serpent-friendly Eve. That's Athena. And in the center of the crucial pediment, which was the most sacred space, the east pediment, the east gable, was depicted Athena's birth. And she, again, was born full-grown from Zeus, which is a picture of Eve being born full-grown out of Adam. And they're celebrating her birth.
The entire structure seems to be then, as you would say, a code. It's a message all by itself, isn't it?
It's a message by itself, but it was meant to be understood. I don't know what has kept us from seeing how obvious all of this is, but it can be read. And I explain in my book, and I've got 251 illustrations in my book, a lot of vase paintings, and you can read these vase paintings as comic book panels. Now, in one of them, we're talking about the Amazons earlier.
Yes.
Everybody's, oh, we're going to find these ancient Amazons. Nobody's found any of these ancient Amazons. They were Noah's outraged daughters. And one vase painter did a whole bunch of these panels of paintings from about 500 B.C. And on the first panel, you can see one of the daughters of Nereus, Noah, being abducted.
Mm-hmm.
And then the daughters are outraged. And then they're running over to their father, and he won't help, the old Noah. It's just too much for him. And he knows that man can't do anything anyhow. I mean, he's talked with God. He's not going to get involved in this. Okay, so then in the very next panel, you see these same women putting on armor, sharpening spears, putting on helmets, putting on greaves, which protect their legs. And they're the same women. They're becoming Amazons. Their father won't do anything, so they are going to...
They're fighting back. Stay with us, Barb.
Hold on.
Keep that thought. We'll be right back.
Subscribe to the After Dark newsletter online at www.coasttocoastam.com. Just click through the orange type to the secure server.
Don't you? out of town in one more show. Downtown, you give me away, but you never came back. No phone, take your place, you know what I mean. We have the same intrigue, we got a game.
From coast to coast and worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
We're going to open up the phone lines next hour, give you an opportunity to talk with our guest Bob Johnson about the Parthenon Code. Let me tell you about the After Dark newsletter, where you get great stories every month, 14 issues for the price of 12. There's a two-month bargain there for you. When you call 1-888-727-5505, you can also go online at coasttocoastam.com. Bob, was it Hollywood that gave us a different impression on what Greek mythology was? I mean, I remember the Hercules movies and issues like that. I mean, are they the ones that really have confused us?
No, I think it's the scholars, and again, it goes back to the curse of the Gorgon Medusa. As long as you're looking straight at Greek mythology, straight at Athena and the other gods and goddesses, you'll never understand what it's about. You have to look away to the book of Genesis to get a frame of reference, and the next thing you know, you see that it's a sophisticated form of ancestor worship that tells you the exact same story as Genesis, but from the point of view that the serpent enlightened mankind.
Now, with the Parthenon Code, with the sculptures that you were talking about and on the vases, did the Greeks leave behind anything else, any kind of writings on tablets or anything like that?
There, one of the architects of the Parthenon was named Ictinos, and it was said that he had written this treatise that explained everything about the Parthenon, and of course it's lost. But can I finish up what I was saying about the Amazons?
Mm-hmm.
I was telling you about that vase, and the vase is like reading, the closest thing I can say is like reading a comic strip, or one of those ancient old classic comics that told the story that way. And that's the way that the Greek artists are telling the story. But anyhow, the first panel, one of Noah's daughters, her name is Thetis, she turned out to be Achilles' mother. She's being abducted, and by a Zeus worshiper. The sisters, and there were, not all of them are shown on the vase, but supposedly this Nereus Noah had 50 daughters. They are up in arms, and they want Noah to do something, and he's just seated there. The old man is seated there. He takes no action.
He doesn't know what to do anymore.
Right, and then he's not going to do anything. He came through the flood. He's not going to get involved in this. And so the next panel, these same women are arming themselves. They're making shields. They're making spears. And then the next thing, they're fighting. And guess who they're fighting? They're fighting Heracles, who represents Athena and Zeus and the whole Greek religious system.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
He's the Nimrod of Genesis. And Heracles is killing them. Then in the final panel, it's Heracles, and guess where he is? He's back in the serpent's garden. He's in the Garden of the Hesperides, and he's picking apples off the serpent-entwined apple tree.
He's back to where it all started.
He's back to where it all started, and they've overcome the Yahweh-believing daughters of Noah. And, of course, he's also depicted as the gods are, killing Noah's Yahweh-believing sons.
Well, is that their way of saying, we don't believe in those beliefs?
We don't believe in those beliefs. We elevate humanity. We're raising humanity up to the heights. And that's what they did. They glorified humanity, and they glorify the gods. They glorify their ancestors as gods, basically, is what they do with
humans, human beings.
Yeah, human beings. If they look exactly like human beings, because that's exactly who they are. They're human beings, and there's no creator god in the Greek religious system. Things to begin for them with Zeus and Hera.
Well, but doesn't it have to start with a creator somehow?
Well,
in reality?
Yeah, I think it has to. But you look today, I mean, there's all kind of people that believe exactly like the Greeks, that just believe in humanism, that believe humans eventually can save themselves, or maybe they can't save themselves, but there's no god behind anything. I mean, it's the opposite viewpoint. And to me...
Do they believe in life after death? Do we know that?
Well, I think they had some very vague beliefs. But, for example, they made Heracles immortal and put him up on the east pediment of the Parthenon, lying back and enjoying himself because of what he did to overcome the Yahweh-believing sons and daughters of Noah for being such a great warrior and so forth. So looking up at, and he was their great hero, looking up at him, and they see him as immortal in a sense. I guess they think that they might be able to achieve some kind of immortality. But a lot of Greeks believe that their immortality was simply in their reputations that lived after their death, such as Achilles and so forth.
As a civilization, Bob, what kind of powerhouse were the Greeks during this entire period? I mean, were they the ones? Were they the you know, the strength of the world at the time?
Well, they came after Babylon and Persia, and then the Persians came from the east and tried to attack them, and then you have the Spartans, 300 Spartans, and hold off the Persians, and they had a couple real big wars with the Persians that they won, both of them, and their era, I guess, lasted about, you know, maybe their authority lasted about 50 years, and that was when they built the Parthenon.
Okay, they did it that quickly, you think?
Though they built the Parthenon, it only took them about 15 years to build the Parthenon.
Well, that's not bad, considering what they talk about the pyramids, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's not bad. What's the Parthenon made out of? Is it marble or granite?
It's made out of marble, and they call it Pentelic marble. There's a mountain about 10 kilometers away called Mount Pentelicon, and they quarried it from there and brought it over. And some of the statues they made, and I've read that it took one man 1 year to carve one statue, and there are hundreds of them on the Parthenon. So I mean, it's a monumental work, and you just can't imagine that they're saying, what are we going to do? Hey, how about Zeus? I mean, it was very meticulously planned. They were telling us in great detail who they were, where they came from, and what they believed.
How in the heck, technically, did they build this structure? I mean, how did they get the marble up there? This stuff's immense.
I don't know. I mean, I have the greatest of respect for the ancient world, and a lot of people think that. See, I think a lot of times Darwin has had a very negative influence on humanity. I mean, imagine that we evolved from slime and tadpoles and monkeys and knuckle dragon troglodytes, you know, coming out of caves, and then if you believe that, you can only look back and see chaos as human history.
Sure.
But if you see it from the standpoint of Genesis, things make sense. And the Greeks saw it that way. I mean, they didn't go for the God of Genesis, but part of their collective cultural memory, the way they remembered how they came into existence was they remembered going back through a flood to a man, a woman, a serpent, and a tree, and an ancient paradise.
See, I think that they must have had some kind of advanced knowledge of things. I mean, I can't imagine, just looking at the picture of the Parthenon, how they could have built the structure up there on Acropolis, unless they had some kind of technology. I mean, it's amazing. I can't figure it out.
Well, they were so brilliant. Now, techne is a Greek word, and that's where we get all our technology.
Yeah.
Then science is Greek. Democracy is Greek. Our art is Greek. Drama, comedy, athletics. You could go on and on. I mean, they created the living basis of our civilization. Why don't we understand what they were trying to tell us in their myth and their art? I mean, that's the importance of the Parthenon Code. And I see there's a book out, you know, the Da Vinci Code.
Yes.
The Da Vinci Code is fiction. There's another book, The Bible Code. The Bible Code has been proven bogus. Then there's the Parthenon Code, Mankind's History in Marble. That actually presents a genuine ancient artist code that reveals the true origins of mankind.
Do other people believe as you do with your interpretation?
My interpretation is too new. And I've gotten, I've got three reviews, separate reviews on my website, and they all use the word original. And one uses seminal, and so forth. It's very original, but it's just it's just eye-opening when you see that Athena is Eve, represents the reborn serpents Eve after the flood, and Zeus and Hera are pictures of Adam and Eve, and Hephaestus, the eldest son of Zeus and Hera, is Cain, the eldest son of Adam and Eve, and that's the side that the Greeks like. They like the side of Cain, and their whole religious system is telling that history and rejoicing in the reestablishment of the way of Cain after the flood and pushing God away again. That's what Atlas is doing, pushing up the heavens. He's pushing away the God of the heavens so mankind can reign supreme on this earth without interference from God.
At some point, a light bulb went off, Bob, in your head, and you started putting this together. What was that?
Well, I was working on the east pediment, and there are these three figures there. You see on the front of the book, the three color
mm-hmm.
figures there.
I mean, have you been there physically, or is this just through research?
Well, I've been to Greece, but almost everything is through research. I've read every book on the subject that has to do with sculpture.
Okay.
All the details, all the books the scholars read, those books that, you know, that only sell about 1,000 and so forth.
300.
Yeah, but they're wonderful books.
Yeah.
They are wonderful books, and these scholars have wonderful information, but they don't have any understanding of what any of it means. I mean, they can tell you the dimensions of the statues. They can tell you, according to Greek myth, who the figures are on the vases. They can tell you, oh, here's Nereus on this vase, here's Nereus on that vase. But it's the easy thing to say, hey, that's Noah. Look at him. Look at who do you think he is if it's not Noah? And but see, I'm getting all
okay. But the bulb in your head. What was it that got you?
Oh,
into
okay.
This?
See, with those three figures there, they are they survived without their heads, and they're in the British Museum. And I read everybody's interpretation of who those three figures were, and then I read a guy named Christian Jeppesen, who was a Dane, and he said they represented the Hesperides, which are the figures that are part of the Garden of the Hesperides. See how they're lounging there? They're always depicted as enjoying themselves because they're Eden means enjoyment and luxury.
I mean, they look like they're waiting for grapes or something.
Well, yeah, they're just total relaxation, and their names are things like red sunset, bubbling water, all that have to do with a paradise. And they're always associated in every vase painting and every sculpture with the serpent entwined apple tree. And some scholars used to say they were three different gods and this. It didn't make any sense for them to be goddesses, I mean, three different gods, because they're looking away from the center of the pediment. This is supposed to be celebrating Athena's birth.
All right, but what was it that got you to think there's more to this than most people have been saying?
Well, that was a big breakthrough there when I saw, hey, wait a minute, this they're depicting the Garden of Eden right on the Parthenon. And then I recognized that this ancient poet Hesiod said that right there in the garden was stood Atlas pushing up the heavens. And so, man, that fit the physical evidence. So once I saw that, then that whole pediment fell into shape. And then I just got more and more confidence in seeing exactly what this was and kept examining the rest of the sculptures until virtually all of them. Oh, by the way, did you know that I'm fairly certain that Cain's killing Abel is depicted on the Parthenon? You have the book there?
I have it. What page should I look at?
77.
Know? Okay, here I go.
And this, you know, there was a long south side to the Parthenon near the cliff, and most of the artwork on that side survived. The center part got blown away, but in 1687. But in 1678, a French artist drew them all. And so we still have his drawings,
okay,
and we
so
know they're accurate because he drew some things that survive and
right.
match.
And so figure 67, I assume, is what you're talking about?
Yeah, but it starts off, again, it's like they tell a story in a panel. In the first panel, there's what appear to be two brothers, one taller and perhaps older than the other. And I'm saying Cain and Abel. Then there's the tall one is with his wife, and it looks like she's presenting a sacrifice. And his gesture is like, what are you doing? You know,
mm-hmm,
and the Greeks
mm-hmm.
were just like we were. Their body language is the same and everything. What are you doing? And, of course, the dispute between Cain and Abel was over the method of sacrifice. And evidently, according to the Greek viewpoint, it had affected Cain's family life and his wife. That's what would have made him so mad and wanted him to kill Abel, is because maybe his wife was going along with that. Then the next thing shows a field, and it looks like the young son is plowing. And that's what it said. They went to a field.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next one shows Cain killing Abel.
Right.
Now, I'm not sure of this, but nobody has any other interpretation for this. And this was on the far back side of the Parthenon, the long side up against the cliff where almost nobody went. And it's sort of where they would put the sort of behind-the-scenes stuff that they didn't, you know, they went right out front. Athena's being gloriously reborn as the serpent-friendly Eve. But in the back, they're telling what the real deal is, what this whole thing's based on. Then there were four more. On the next page, there were four more of these sculptures with people in it that I can't make hide nor hair of, and maybe somebody will get the book and figure it out. But, I mean, you can see that it's in the last panel, they're opening a scroll. They're unrolling a scroll. What scroll is that?
Well, how in the heck could there be so many similarities between what you read in Genesis, what Greek mythology is, what the Parthenon Code is? How could they be all similar? It's got to tell you something.
Well, it tells us that the book of Genesis is true, and that it's the Greeks carved that story in stone. The Parthenon sculptures cry out that there was an Eden, that there's a way of Cain, that there was a flood, that everything that Genesis says, it cries it out.
Now, you mentioned the book of Revelation.
Uh-huh.
Do the Greeks discuss end times at all? Or anything like that?
I've never seen anything. That's a good question. I've never really even thought about that, about what they thought of as prophecy. But they're talking about the future. They're celebrating the present.
Right. They really don't get into the future then, do they?
I don't think so. And maybe somebody out there could correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't remember seeing anything that indicated that they're predicting anything's going to happen.
Nowhere have you talked about, and I've got to ask you this, what we all have known is the name of Hercules. Where does he fit into any of this, or does he?
Well, Heracles.
Hercules.
Well, Hercules is the Roman name for Heracles.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, you look at... he is the Nimrod of Genesis. Nimrod, it says in Genesis that Nimrod, after the flood, was the first to wax mighty in the earth. And Heracles' given name was Alcaeus in Greek, which means mighty one. Okay? And he does the same things that Nimrod is described as doing. He becomes the first conqueror after the flood. And they just transplant him. They tell it from the Greek point of view. They transplant him to Greek soil. And his, again, as I've said before, his labors chronicle the reestablishment of the way of Cain after the flood. He has to overcome the three-bodied Geryon, who represents the authority of the sons of Noah. He has to kill an Amazon and take her belt. And, of course, she is one of the Yahweh-believing sons, daughters of Noah. And then he finally gets back in his 12th labor to the garden, where he gets the apples. And what's he do with them? He gives them to Athena, because now... she's the new Eve of the Greek age, and she gets these precious golden apples, and she's going to rule. Zeus is going to rule the Greek world through her.
You know, it's something how they depict what they think and what may be going on through artwork. It really is.
It's a set of symbols that they had, and it was not meant for some super educated elite to grasp. It was meant for average Greeks to understand.
Do you think one guy did it all, or they had a group of artists doing this?
I think they had a group of artists, and that they sifted out the traditions and so forth that weren't germane. For example, there's some people said, well, you know, it says that there's this couple, Deucalion and Pyrrha. They were the ones that survived the flood. Well, some ancient poet said that. Well, the Greek artists never depict them. Never. They're never painted and they're never sculpted. They're always depicting Nereus and his wife Doris.
All right, stay with us, Bob. We've got another hour to go. We're going to open up the phone lines, okay? Back in a moment, right here on Coast to Coast AM.
Find out more about tonight's guest. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.
those fingers in my hair, that sly come hither stare, that strips my conscience bare, it's witchcraft. And I've got no defense for it, the heat is too intense for it, what good would common sense for it do? 'Cause it's witchcraft, wicked witchcraft. And although I know it's strictly taboo, when you arouse the need in me, my heart says yes indeed in me. Proceed with what you're leading me to. It's such an ancient pitch, but one I wouldn't switch, 'cause there's no nicer witch than you.
To talk with George Norrie, call the Wildcard line at area code 818-501-4109. The first-time caller line is area code 818-501-4721. To talk with George toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll-free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach George Norrie by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
My heart says, and we're going to open up the phone lines for you with our guest, Robert Bowie Johnson, back in a moment, right here, Coast to Coast AM. Bob, before we go to calls, talk a little bit more about what you were talking about in the beginning of the program about the Greek gods defeating the giants. Why did they call them giants? Because, as you mentioned, you didn't believe they were giants the way we understand giants to be.
Well, I've got a couple chapters on this in the Parthenon Code, but they were spiritual giants. They were the Yahweh-believing sons of Noah, and whenever they're depicted in Greek art, they are depicted as really being vanquished, and sometimes a god is killing one of these giants, and they don't appear any bigger than a god, so they're not giants in that sense. Sometimes a serpent is entwining and helping the god to show that, you know, what's happening is the serpent system is taking over and vanquishing them. That's the biggest celebration, or one of the biggest celebrations. That, of course, along with this, the rebirth of the serpent's Eve, the rebirth of the serpent-friendly Eve comes into being as the giants are defeated by the Greek gods. And this was depicted on the east side of the Parthenon. It was depicted on the great altar of Zeus at Pergamum, which is in the book of Revelation is called the throne of Satan. And it's depicted on vase after vase after vase about defeating these. And they, it's funny, some of them are named, and a lot of them have El or Al in their name, which is the Hebrew name for God. Like one of the giants' names was Enkel-El-Ados, and several others have it. I always wondered about that, if there was any connection with that, because who knows what happened after the Tower of Babel? I mean, how languages developed, changed, and how that's really what caused the dispersion after the flood. That's what really got everybody moving around and having a different language and somewhat different cultures.
Do you think the flood could have been caused by perhaps an asteroid splashing into the ocean and then just inundating land?
Well, it says it in Genesis. It says it came up. The earth really shook, and Poseidon, who took over from Noah in the Greek system to be the god of the sea. He's known as the Earth Shaker. And the earth shook, and it came up from these deep springs in the earth, and then it started to rain down, according to Genesis. And the way I read Genesis, it had never rained before. So this really must have terrified the line of Cain that was basically that was meant to wipe them out. But I don't think it was a, it was God's operation, and however he did it. I mean, he can use any means he wants, whether natural or supernatural.
Right. I mean, and it could have been an asteroid. I guess, right?
Sure.
Okay, let's go to some phones. Let's go, if we can, first of all, east of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello.
Welcome to the program.
Yeah, George and Robert. My name's Paul, and I'm north of Dallas a little ways. My question, I have actually two questions, I guess. One, have you found any parallels to the prophecies of Jesus in Greek mythology, and if not, is it something that you'd consider to look for?
Okay, well, I mentioned, I don't know if you heard what we were talking about, how Jesus was speaking in Revelation chapter 2, verse 13, about where the throne of Satan is, at a place called Pergamum. And when you go to Pergamum, what you find there is the altar of Zeus, and that altar of Zeus disappeared into the earth for a while, and then in 1930 was reassembled in Berlin right before Adolf Hitler took power. Now, I think the Apostle Paul certainly talks about Athena when he talks in the book of Romans, I think it's Romans 1:21, about unbelieving mankind. And unbelieving mankind, it says that he was in Athens. First of all, Paul was in Athens, and so it's logical to assume that he did visit the Parthenon and did see Athena's huge idol image in there. And he says that about these kind of people, that they don't thank or glorify God, but vain are they made in their reasonings, and darkened is their unintelligent heart. And alleging themselves to be wise, which is what the Greeks did, they are made stupid, and they change the glory of the incorruptible God into the likeness of an image of a corruptible human being, and that would be Eve, who Athena represents, and flying creatures, and there were flying creatures on Athena's helmet, and she held Nike, another flying creature, in her hands, and quadrupeds. Well, the Sphinx was in the middle of her helmet. That's a quadruped, and there were two other quadrupeds on her helmet, and reptiles. And, of course, there was a huge reptile rising up next to her, and then the head of serpents, the Gorgon Medusa, was on her breastplate. So it seems fairly certain to me that what Paul is describing here is the ancient idol image of Athena in the Parthenon.
Symbols or reality, Bob, these images?
Well, they're symbols of the reality that...
The interpretation, I guess, of the artist.
Well, I mean, these interpretations are consistent. These themes don't vary. They keep having the same things over and over again in Greek art. They've got the Greeks defeating the Amazons. They've got the Greeks, or the gods, overcoming the giants, the Yahweh-believing sons of Noah. They've got Athena's birth. They show the rebirth of the line of Cain. They keep showing these things over and over and over again, and they all say the same thing. Our religious system has overcome the system of Noah and his children.
Let's go to our international line. Where are you calling from? Hi there.
Hi. I'm calling from Baja.
Oh, well, welcome to the program. Hi.
Thank you. I wanted to let you know that when you came back on the air, it was 11 minutes after 1 Pacific time. You and your 1:11 thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay.
I timed that. I plan it that
on.
Way.
This is probably one of the first rational explanations of Greek mythology that actually seems to match their philosophy of life, that sound mind, sound body sort of rationalism. I was wondering two things. I missed the Greek name equivalent to Seth, and I wondered where I might read about the Bible code proven bogus.
Oh, the Bible. Oh, just go. First of all, the Bible code proven bogus. I would go on the internet and
okay.
just type in the Bible code. And the way I understand it, they've found out that you apply the same computer technique to books like Moby Dick and Huckleberry Finn, and you come up with prophecies out of those books, too. They're kind of bogus. And to me, the guy that wrote the book, I read the book, admits he's a secular journalist. So, and he's writing about the Bible. It says in the scriptures that Paul prays that those in the body of Christ would receive a spirit of wisdom and revelation and the realization of God. To understand the scriptures, you have to have that spirit. There's no doubt about it. Well, he doesn't even believe. So how's he coming up with that? Then his conclusion is, in his book, is that from this scanty little evidence, he says, well, this just proves that we can save ourselves, he says. And that, if he's read anything in scripture, the scriptures say just the opposite. So that's what I think. But the Parthenon Code, my book, Mankind's History in Marble, is a thoroughly documented ancient artist code that tells the truth about the origins of mankind. And you could, the Greek artists meant the Greeks of that time to understand exactly what it was. It's simple. Once you get a few of the key things, you can start understanding this yourself. You can look at ancient vases and understand what's going on there, what's really going on.
Right. And, according to their perspective. And it's basically a repeat of the Torah itself.
Well, yeah, it's
but through with their interpretation.
But they had their own collective cultural memory of things.
Right.
They had a memory of this ancient garden, which they called the Garden of the Hesperides, which always had a serpent and twine apple tree in it. They had a memory of the flood. They had a memory of the first couple being a brother-sister, husband-wife pair that they called Zeus and Hera. It wasn't like they went over and they got some scrolls from the Hebrews and said, well, let's see how you see it. The reason their whole system, all their sculpture, all their art, all their myth screams out that they came from a place where there was a woman, a man, a serpent, and a tree in an ancient paradise. That's what then, and they celebrate the reemergence of the way of Cain after the flood and the glorious victory of mankind and man's spirit over Noah and his Yahweh-believing children.
Tell me about the name Seth again.
Oh, Seth. Well, okay. Now, Adam and Eve had two children after Abel was murdered by Cain. Cain was the eldest son, and Seth replaced him. Now, in Greek mythology, Zeus and Hera had two children also. The eldest was Hephaestus, and he represents Cain, and they loved him. He was the armorer of the gods. He was the favorite son. The other son that corresponded to Seth was Ares, and most people just called him the god of war. But if you read Homer, you can see where Zeus himself calls his son hateful and pestilent. And Homer says horrible things about him. They didn't really worship Ares. They recognized him because he was a historical figure. It's just like in Christianity and Judaism, nobody likes the way of Cain, but you can't get rid of him. You can't kick him out of the scriptures. Well, the Greeks had the same situation. The reality was Zeus and Hera had two kids, just like Adam and Eve, because that's who they represented. And Ares was hated by his own father, and he even said that if you weren't my son by Hera, you wouldn't even have any place at all on Olympus. So that's the answer to that. And Ares, throughout Greek myth, the Greek heroes have to kill sons of Ares. And when they take this belt from an Amazon. When Heracles takes a belt from an Amazon, it was given to her by Ares, i.e. Seth. On the road to get to the Garden of the Hesperides to get the apples, Heracles kills Ares' favorite son, Kyknos, and wounds Ares. Imagine that. But that's because, and it only makes sense if you see who Ares really is. He's Seth. And that's through whom the line of Christ is traced in the scriptures.
Well, let me tell you something. You know the names. I'll give you that. First time caller line. Welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Hi there.
Yes, sir.
My name's Rick, and I'd like to say that what I have heard tonight from Robert Johnson has just been absolutely incredible. And I think I have something to offer on the Noah flood.
Yes.
Noah, we know that the oceans have risen and we have cities underneath the water.
True.
It would indicate that we've had an inundation of water that did not exist at one time. They've speculated that it might be the ice caps melting and various sundry things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think it's like Velikovsky indicated, that there had been a collision between Mars and Earth. And we know that Richard Hoagland's looking for where the water went to from Mars.
Right.
I believe it came here in a 40-day rain of water from that planet to this one.
You know what? A lot of that is very possible. I mean, whatever the calamity was, it was a big one.
It was a big one. It was a big one.
Do they ever, does in mythology, Robert, and thank you for your question and your comments, do they ever talk about the celestial things? Does that happen?
Well, now that's very interesting. That Noah's cloak is pictured, or Nereus. Now, he's the Greek Noah. His name means the wet one. He's
right.
Also the salt sea old man. I've got 17 vase depictions of him in the Parthenon Code, and he's depicted in a couple of them wearing a star-studded cloak. And in another place where Atlas is pushing away the heavens, you can see where the artist has drawn stars on what he's pushing up to show it's part of the heavens. And that's what they're trying to get rid of. They're trying to get rid of that celestial influence, the Greeks are, and get it back to an earthly thing where man rules the earth without God, and God is out of the picture, and humanity is going to determine its own destiny. And I haven't said much about Noah's cloak, but there's a place in Genesis, because Athena stole it, believe it or not, and it appeared on the Parthenon, but now it's in the British Museum. But it's there, because the biggest celebration of all they had every year celebrating Athena's birthday involved the presentation to her of a cloak. And it wasn't a celestial star-studded cloak like Noah once wore. It was embroidered with scenes of the gods defeating, killing the giants, killing the Yahweh-believing sons of Noah. That was the big celebration, so they would give her that great cloak. But it's Noah's cloak. If you go back, if you remember in Genesis, Noah got drunk and naked in his tent. And people don't understand why that's mentioned in Scripture. And he'd been on a ship on the ark for a year with his family, and that would make anybody want to have a drink, I think. And, and so it took him a while, though, because he had to grow the grapes. I mean, so he finally drank and got drunk and fell asleep naked. But it doesn't have to do with his drunkenness or nakedness, because he didn't bother anybody. And his drunkenness was, that warm wine feeling more than anything.
Right,
undoubtedly.
Right. It wasn't an intoxication that we think of a drunk today, for example.
Right, and he didn't bother anybody. So what was it really about? It was about his cloak. When he was naked, he was separated from the symbol of his authority, what he wore. Now, way back then, Noah was the most important man in the world, obviously, and he was extremely revered by those that were living. And he had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And Ham went in there and saw him naked and then ran out to his brothers and said, he doesn't have his cloak on, let's take his cloak and let's take his authority now. The older brothers didn't like that, and they didn't even want to see their father separated from that cloak. So they went in and picked the cloak up and walked backwards and put it over him, so that he wouldn't even see their father separated from the symbol of his authority. So Noah's cloak in the ancient world was a huge symbol of his authority and spiritual authority.
Why was Noah so important in Greek mythology?
Because it's how the Greek religious system defines itself. The Greek religious system is about overcoming that system, about reestablishing the way of Cain after the flood. Now, on many of the vases on which Nereus, the Greek Noah, appears, and in sculpture, that the Greeks put him there for a very special reason. He's put, for example, in a scene that shows the birth of Athena, full grown out of Zeus. He's there, hey, look, here's the reference point, and this is what's happening. This is what's happening, Noah. Things are changing. He's pictured with his wife Doris witnessing the gods killing the giants. They're his Yahweh-believing sons. On the altar of Zeus at Pergamum, he and his wife are the only ones that aren't engaged in the fighting. They're standing in the corner, and the Greek artists put them there for a reason to show, this has to do with overcoming Noah's system. He was forced by the artist, put him in the scene of his daughter's marriage, who had been abducted from him. He's put in that scene, see what I'm saying? The artists are telling us, they're using him as and the entire Parthenon, there are seven sculptural themes. every theme relates to Noah in some significant way.
No, well, here's another quick question for you. We're going to take this break. But over what period of time did the artist do what he did as opposed to the real event? Example, I mean, were these stories passed down from ear to ear? Did the Noah's flood story occur thousands of years before the Greeks put this down in the Parthenon?
You know, that's a good question for somebody to search out, because exactly how the knowledge was passed on. We know that it was there because it began to be expressed in the art around 600 BC.
All right, we'll be right back, Robert. Stay with us.
Get it in writing with the After Dark newsletter. Subscribe by calling 1-888-727-5505.
To my 45s, ain't it wonderful to be alive when the rock and roll plays? Yeah, when the memory stays, yeah, I'm keeping the faith. Yeah, 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 keeping the faith. I'm keeping the faith. Yes, I'm.
With George Norrie, call the Wildcard line at area code 818-501-4109. The first-time caller line is area code 818-501-4721. To talk with George toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll-free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach George Norrie by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free, 800-893-0903. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
On our next Coast to Coast program, our guest will be Kevin Warwick. You've heard of the movie I, Robot. He's written a book called I, Cyborg. And he believes that one day robots could dominate the world with dire consequences for all of this. That'll be on our next Coast to Coast program. But we'll continue now with our friend Rob Johnson, and we'll be back with your phone calls in a moment. With a verse of... Bob, does the god Hades, H-A-D-E-S, ever come up at all in any of this mythology?
Well, he's really not a figure so much as a place. Hades in Greek means the unseen. And Heracles has to go down there to perform a couple things, and he actually pulls up this, and one of his laborers pulls up this dog named Kerberos, and every time the artists depicted this dog. He had a serpent tail or serpents coming out of his face, and the symbolism seems pretty obvious. What Pericles is doing, he's reaching back into the past, going down into Hades, the unseen, and pulling back the power of the serpent. But now Hades, some people think it means death. In the scriptures, Hades is mistranslated as hell.
Exactly.
And hell is the Norse goddess of the underworld. She doesn't have any place in the scriptures. Hades means the unseen. And it's the Greek equivalent of the Hebrew word Sheol, which means the same thing, the unseen. So
I got to get you on a debate with some theologians. That'd be an interesting program.
Well, theologians are pretty easy because they generally, they don't, I know you may think they believe the scriptures, but theologians believe their theology, and they believe their denominational dogma. It's a different thing to believe the scriptures, and you really need the most accurate translation, which is the concordant literal translation. Because translation is adding and taking away, mistranslation is adding to and taking away from the Word of God simultaneously. So you got to have an accurate English translation.
Let's go back to the phones. West of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. How you doing?
Doing well, thanks.
Robert, as a man who was raised in theology, I have broken away from theology, and I'm writing a book. And the main theme of my book is a term I've called Bereidabab Peromavat, which is tracing the beginning. In Genesis 1:1, the word beginning is Bereshith, which means in beginnings, Yahweh, in other words, in stages, Yahweh created everything. From there to Eden to Babylon, when Babylon was invaded by Persia, they moved the priesthood of Nimrod to Pergamon. You're absolutely correct. And when the Roman culture came into power, they had no culture. They adopted the culture of the Greeks. And from Pergamon to the Roman culture, all of the ancient symbols and all of these sculptures that you're talking about can be found on one place on planet Earth right now, and it is a place called Vatican City. And the word Vatican in Latin means the divining serpent. And
oh, my God.
I am just so unbelievably shocked to hear someone who has found the truth. If you don't know, if people don't understand the Greek mythology and the Greek culture, because Yeshua in the New Testament, every time he spoke in metaphors and idioms of the Greek culture. And I am just so proud to hear there is another man out there on planet Earth who understands this.
All right, thanks for your comments. So there you go. There's a nice compliment for you, Bob.
Very, very, very enlightening.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, welcome.
Well, I wanted to ask Robert a question.
Well, you are more than welcome to. Go ahead.
Robert, did Circe come up in the mythology?
Circe, that like the witch?
Well, she was like a temptress that led the sailors to their death.
Uh-huh.
And from what I understand, she was like a consort of Nimrod, which if you're telling us right, Nimrod was Zeus?
No, Nimrod is Heracles.
Is Heracles.
Yeah, the great hero, because that's what Nimrod did. He, by force of arms, he was the first to wax mighty in the earth and became the first great king after the flood, which is what Heracles was from the Greek point of view.
But Heracles went back to the garden.
Yes.
And got the apple and gave it to Athena.
Yes. That's right.
Well, did you not know that Hussein himself considered himself Nimrod and was rebuilding the garden?
Nimrod or Nebuchadnezzar?
Uh-uh.
No, he considered himself Nebuchadnezzar.
Was it Nebuchadnezzar?
Yes, yes.
Well, I was thinking it was Nimrod.
No, he thought of himself as Nebuchadnezzar. As a matter of fact, he even named one of his armies the Nebuchadnezzar division.
Okay, how does Melchizedek play into this?
Well, I can only say that based on what Glenn Kimball has said about Melchizedek, that this is an entity, a person, who apparently has lived on and on and on through various civilizations from almost the beginning of time, from the biblical days on, according to Glenn Kimball, through King Arthur time. I don't think he went back to Greek mythology, though, Bob, do you?
No, I mean, he's a puzzling figure. But are you talking about Glenn Campbell, the singer?
No, Glenn Kimball.
Oh. Okay. All right.
Close.
Okay. No, I don't know. I know Melchizedek's a very mysterious figure, and he ministered to Abraham way back.
Okay, let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for taking my call, George.
My pleasure. Go ahead.
My name is Marcel, and I was born in Greece, and I have something to add. It's a comment. And I think that the reason I called is because you were talking about creation myths, and you mentioned revelations in the end times. And I think the answer to that question can be found in Aristotle, which Aristotle talked about the prime mover and change and... like, if I pick up something from a table, I have to move my arm to pick that up from the table, and there's constant change. And Aristotle, if Aristotle were alive today, and if he were alive when Genesis was written, he would have said that the world never had a beginning and has no end. And that's basically all I really had to say, is just that from philosophy, apart from mythology, Aristotle, and I think Aristotle is indicative of the way the Greeks thought, and he didn't believe that the world ever had a beginning and will never have an end.
Your take, Bob?
I really don't have one on that.
Fair enough. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
First time caller, long time listener. I've got two or three statements and then a couple of observations, and I'll hang up and I'll be very pleased to hear the answers.
Okay, sir.
The first instance, the Garden of Good, the Garden of Eden with the tree and the serpent, is an archetype which, if you read anything by Fraser or Campbell or Eliot Merce, is pretty much of a universal. The snake is a phallocentric piece of symbolism that's related to the sun, whereas the tree is a Gaia-centric or lunar-centric feminine symbol that represents the axis mundi. Templating a piece of standard Greek mythos into the Old Testament is really just a very specious piece of pick and choose what you think fits and then manipulate it to fulfill your theory. The second thing regarding the flood, the oldest written example of the flood happens to be the Epic of Gilgamesh, and the oldest Noah is Utnapishtim, and that far predates both Greek and Old Testament literature. And as I said, I think doing a pick and choose Old Testament Bible and fit in and reinterpret pre-existing mythos into an Old Testament situation is, at the very least, I think, a piece of specious and pick and choose mythology. And I'll be happy to listen to the response. Thank you.
All right. The response is yours if you want to, Bob.
Well, I think you need to read my book. I mean, my book is nothing but evidence. And the evidence, I've got 251 vase depictions of, with the help of a computer artist. We've reconstructed the East pediment in color based on the physical evidence of the Parthenon. Again, the book is The Parthenon Code, Mankind's History in Marble. You can go to my website, theparthenoncode.com. There are sample chapters. There's a lot of information. There's nothing specious about what I'm doing. It's obvious that Athena is the serpent-friendly Eve, and that she's her being born full-grown out of Zeus is an obvious picture of Eve being born full-grown out of Adam. And it just goes on and on. And, you know, from Zeus and Hera being a husband-wife, brother-sister pair, to having two children and everything fitting. Like, I'm not trying to pick and choose anything. I mean, the Greeks are telling a story in their art. Now, we give the Hebrews credit for knowing who they are, where they came from, and what they believed, and being able to express that in writing. Let's give the Greeks credit for knowing who they were, where they came from, and what they believed. And a lot of what you say comes from Joseph Campbell. Joseph Campbell although he's very popular, he's never understood the meaning of Greek myth, and he never would have. He has utter contempt for the book of Genesis, and he says only children take that seriously. Nobody of adult mind would take Genesis seriously. Even if you don't believe Genesis, it's such an ancient scroll, it deserves scrutiny, no matter what you believe. And going along with Campbell, since not believing Genesis, not giving any credence to Genesis, you can't possibly understand what Greek myth means. And it's very much like reading a book by a guy who believes the earth is flat, there might be some interesting things he has to say here and there, but fundamentally, his whole system is flawed.
Now, speaking of the book, how do we get yours, the Parthenon Code?
ThePartheNonCode.com. This is the website, and
are you on Amazon?
We're on Amazon, Barnes and Noble. It's on Barnes and Noble.
Okay.
And
so that's pretty available.
It's pretty available. It's making its way to bookstores now. The official publication date is, I mean, it's available for shipment, but its official publication date is the 15th, and we're going to...
We got you really fresh then, don't we?
Oh, yeah, and it's really going to heat up here as we get to the Olympics, and everybody's going to want to know. Now, your listeners know something about the Parthenon. These scholars that have written about it and talk about it, they don't know anything about it. They can't tell. Imagine, these people created the living basis of our culture, and we don't know what they're trying to tell us in the most sculpted temple from Greek antiquity. I mean, that's like, hey, wait a minute, and it's because, when you were in school, the teacher would say, put your thinking cap on. Put your thinking cap on and look at these things. Like when somebody tells you, well, Athena is the goddess of wisdom. Say, hey, no, wait a minute. Look at her. She's the goddess of the serpent's wisdom. She's got serpents all over her. Look at that. You know what I mean? You just use your common sense. The Greeks, that's the thing about the Parthenon Code, Mankind's History in Marble. It shows that ancient Greek myth and art is meant to be understood. It's geared to average people. It's simple languages, simple symbols are expressed by these Greek artists to let people know what's going on, what they believe, who they are, where they came from. And it all has to do with Genesis. Noah's cloak's on the Parthenon. Athena took it. The olive branch, Athena took it. The dove, there's pictures of the dove landing on Zeus's arm. All the symbols from Genesis the Greeks took, and they appropriated it because they're saying the New Age belongs to the Greek gods. The New Age belongs to Zeus and the reborn serpent's Eve, the reborn serpent-friendly Eve. The New Age belongs to the rejuvenated way of Cain. The New Age belongs to humanism, and God is pushed out of the picture. Atlas pushes away the heavens, and with them the God of the heavens, so that this humanistic system can develop and the serpent system can be exalted.
Now, though your interpretation may be right on the button of Greek mythology, the big question remains is who was right, those who put together Genesis or the mythologists of Greece?
Well, they're both right. That's just it's the opposite spin on the same events. The Greeks looked at it as the serpent enlightened mankind, and they were glad to get free from the god of Genesis. They felt like they wanted the knowledge of good and evil. This is really what humanity needs, you know, to develop. And this is what has to happen if there's going to be a Savior. I mean, if the Scriptures are true and Jesus Christ is the Savior, there's got to be a lost humanity. And the Greeks fill the bill perfectly.
All right, let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I'm calling from New Orleans, listening on WSMB.
Absolutely. One of our favorites.
I'd like to ask him, is there a correlation between the superhuman attributes these deities had and the byproduct that was created from the alchemical philosopher's stone, which was a drinkable gold-like liquid that the alchemists created on a way of transmuting base metals into gold, and it would supposedly turn a person young, give them superhuman strength. For instance, Comte Saint Germain, that supposed alchemist in the Middle Ages, supposedly lived a long time and had a very strange physiological quality.
I have no idea.
Well, let me say something else, part two of that. Are you familiar? First of all, the Philosopher's Stone was called the Red Dragon in alchemy. Do you know, as far as mythology in ancient Egypt with Isis and Osiris and Set, after that trial and tribulation was over, supposedly those gods... Set's punishment was damnation in the Hades, and he was supposedly reincarnated in Greek mythology as Typhon, which was a dragon.
Or any reaction to that?
I don't discuss any of this in this kind of thing in the Parthenon Code. I deal strictly with the relationship of Greek mythology to the early events described in Genesis and to decoding the sculptures on the Parthenon and Greek myth and Greek art in general. The other things, I haven't heard of half this stuff.
Well, and let me tell you, at least you know what's refreshing. If you don't know it, you say it. And you know, so many people just continue to ramble on and on about things they're not aware of.
I've been known to do that.
Look, the clock is going to get us here, Bob. We've only got about a minute or so left. If people want to do their own research, they want to do a little bit more in-depth work, what do they do? Just go to the website?
Go to theparthenoncode.com. There's a lot. Good. The features, there's all kind of features there. I've got pictures. You decide. Look, I got vase depictions of Noah from ancient Greece, and you can look at them and say, hmm. And I've got a lot of articles. I've got a summary of Greek myth as part of the features that appeared in an international journal, very simply written summary, and that's actually chapter 2 of the Parthenon Code. I incorporated that in there as a summary. And it's a great website, all kind of information there. And also you can look at the east pediment of the Parthenon restored in color. That's where the Greeks, that was the most sacred sculpted space in the ancient Greek world.
Well, I got to tell you, very timely with the Olympics right around the corner here. Bob, thank you so much.
George, thank you. I appreciate it.
You take
really
care
fun.
Of yourself. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesor, Barbara Simpson, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.